Welcome to part two of our interview with Stephen Asher about the Western State Lunatic Asylum. How would staff essentially explain something like that? I mean, when they're doing charts on patients and things of that nature to document how they're doing on a day-to-day basis, and when something like this comes up and happens and is verifiable by someone, a staff member, not a patient, where it could be written off as a story that someone is telling. I mean, how is that handled in a case like that?
The facility, just like any hospital institution, because anything like it is institutionalized, you have the line officer or you have the orderly. You have the sergeant or what would be considered like the charge nurse, and then the captain or lieutenant, which would be like the head nurse. Then you have people coming in, which would be the doctors on rounds, the staff physician, psychiatrist, and then their higher ups who actually facilitate changes and policies in the facility. What happens more often than not is no one wants to take that to their boss. No one wants to look like they're rocking the apple cart and all that. Not that if a person is violently hurt in some which way, and it's something, especially if it looks like they might get sued, if someone gets bumped up a little bit, they just kind of write it off too. Well, people have different episodes. People, maybe if they have, you know, seizures or they have delusions for whatever they at that moment might have had this and that going on. If a person has a violent muscle contraction, it might feel like you're being strangled or held down. They're going to try to find a way, which, and understandably, you don't want to go straight to, this man's got a fever. Well, there you go. You got ghosts in your blood. Let's get the leeches. You know, obviously, we're not that anymore. So they try to find a rational explanation to it. But it's just a thing that, more often than not, that is, I don't want to say suppressed, but that is definitely not even taken into the realm of possibilities due to that fact, due to the fact that it opens you up for all kinds of conjecture and lawsuits and whatever. You know, there's going to be somebody like, well, hey, my son has to be out of there. He said he's being possessed. And he needs to come out of this institution, or he needs to be whatever. He needs to get a better room. The one he has gremlins in it. You're going to have all that. Mm-hmm. That's just the nature of it. And that's unfortunately what happens. But what is bad is, and that can be true, and that will happen, but especially someone that I know, or as far as I am in regards to a judge, seems competent, seems at themselves, seems in control of reality. You know, it's really hard not to take what they say as what they felt, especially when they seem like they really have felt it. You can see the emotion in their face even now. And, you know, even though people have said, you know, eyewitness reports is like the worst thing in the world, you know, people just went to prison on that and come to find out it wasn't true or whatever. But and if this person was the type of person that's seeing spooks around every corner, again, you have to vet people and you have to look at the situation. Because, you know, I had people bringing me goofy stories, you know, all kinds of stuff. They're almost like goblins and whatnot, you know, and there was nothing else to it. There was no other. You know, if there was like one person with maybe just one little odd story, but if you have three, four, five people and it's been that way, and someone's like, yeah, my aunt, my uncle, my cousin, and you have a continuation of said phenomena, that gives a little bit more weight to.
Sure.
So, but yeah, that's kind of what you run into, just like at the penitentiary.
Yeah. Do you think that people who are in there or had been in there, I'm talking more in past tense than anything else, legitimately suffering from mental illness, do you think that they were targeted or tormented by these forces on the other side because they were in such a state of, you know, not a great place, not a great mental state?
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say someone who is, for lack of a better term, mentally or emotionally incapacitated,
mm-hmm.
I think that you are you're easy prey.
Yeah.
Not to kind of you know take something from the Catholic exorcist rule book, but it's like, look, you know, if you're not whole, if you're not mentally together, if you're not focused, do not go out and do battle. And I even had said something similar to guys I've had in my group, the Caldwell County Paranormals. Like, look, you know, I know you're having stuff going on at home. Why don't you take the night off? Let's not do this. Or there's been times when I'm like, hey, I've got this and that going on. You know, when my mother and father passed away just short of a year of each other. And I said, you know, guys, I'm taking a week or two off. I'm not where I feel I'm going to be beneficial to anybody. So, you know, you really have to make sure you are, you know, emotionally and spiritually together. Mm-hmm. Just because I do think it's just like any other predator. Who are they going to pick off? They're going to pick off the weakest of the herd, the one who's straggling, the one that's obviously able to be manipulated or preyed upon more easily. And I think that's just the nature of a predator. So yeah, I would say that's totally factual. I'm sure that's probably how it happens more often than not, because they always hear that, well, there's this guy walking down the street and he's talking to himself. Well, I mean, maybe he's not necessarily talking to himself. Maybe he is encountering something, but he can't really articulate it in a way, or he can't break the difference between reality and whatever this thing is that he's dealing with from what's in front of him. Mm-hmm. And that's where it gets real scary with people. And it's very sad, too. You know, I'm sorry, I was just saying. Because, like I said, when I wrote Hauntings of the Kentucky State Penitentiary, there was a vibe of people going, well, you know, these guys are in there for really hard crimes. You know, well, they seem some spooks. Well, boo-hoo on them. You know, sometimes you get guys like that. But there's very few people, you know, me included, you have someone in there for a treatment or there because they cannot function anywhere else. They're already, you know, a marginalized person and pretty much a sad creature. I mean, and then you add this on top of it, it's heartbreaking. But you started to say something. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it's just we always hear stories of folks. Oftentimes, when they're sharing their stories of a paranormal encounter, it quite often begins with, "And I was going through this very difficult time in my life, or I had this illness, or I had this or that," and it almost seems like something that would be, you know, preying on that weakness that individual is experiencing. And when you have a whole building that's filled with people who are suffering from various things. That obviously has a lot of activity in it. It just seems like, you know, it's the fox in the hen house.
Well, sure. And, you know, I kind of make jokes because, like I said, it's kind of a heavy subject, but, you know, I guarantee no one bought a slap chop or like the belt punch at 10 o'clock during the day at work or something. It's someone who's either a shut in or whatever, 3 a.m. They're, you know, kind of daisy, not really at their highest functioning levels, that buy that stuff. You know, so what I'm saying is, so it's easier to be manipulated when you're in that position. Mm-hmm. And it does seem like, I don't know why that is. It just, it does very much seem to be the MO of that.
I mean, it's like you said earlier, a predator, you know, in the living is going to go after the weakest. It's the same principle when it's something on the other side as well. Have there been any stories from patients or staff of encountering the same entity or the same experience to you know, almost cross-reference and cross-confirm that, oh, yeah, I had that exact same thing happen or I saw that exact same thing, too?
Well, there has been a report, and I need to try to get you probably get you the picture of this. This was taken by a staff member who's now passed on, and once they built the new facility, and as you see, it has the large bell tower on the top, big silver dome, and there's a large staircase that goes up there. It's, you know, and people have reported feeling odd things and feeling stuff rush past them and whatnot. And one time this gentleman had actually taken a photo of what looks like almost like it looked more feminine to me than male, a female in sort of a shroud. You know, head from the head almost to the feet. The feet were bare, and you could kind of see them coming down the steps. And they started getting the name of the White Lady of Western State. And it's very similar to, like, say if you see, like, in the old graveyards where you would have, like, the angel or, like, a woman and she's dropping the flowers, you know, that type of thing, like a large stone thing, the alabaster-looking skin. It's kind of what it looked like. But as far as I know, this, you know, I've not ran it through a machine, but as far as I know, this has not been touched. You know, it was straight from the reel to whatever. But I've had several people report that, and sometimes it's just a weird happenstance, and it's not so much that they're coming at them. It's almost like it's just one of those more benign, like, hello, hi, I'm here. You know, sometimes before, like maybe a very bad storm, and that could tie in with the electrical activity of a storm and thunderstorms, it seems like her presence there is stronger. Her ability to, and I'm using her as, because I don't know what it is, her ability to manifest is more easily acclimated with the surroundings. So, you know, and I'm not for sure what the story on that is. You know, there's been a whole lot of different speculation on what that was and who that was. And so, I mean, that's one of those deals where I reported it, but I couldn't necessarily nail down who it was because, you know, I try to keep it as close to what I've heard. You know, obviously I have a certain amount of, freedom to do whatever with it, but, you know, I try to connect the dots as closely to factual as I can. There's another area I was talking to you about, the TB area on the upper walks, which is now doctor's offices. As I'd mentioned, there had been a county poorhouse, and sometimes it wouldn't be just old folks that went in there. Sometimes it's people with younger kids, or maybe, you know, older folks who are raising younger kids, which happens, you know, even today. Well, if these old people age out, and say those young children, you know, meaning age up and they pass away, these young children have no one to go to. You know, they would either go to Home of the Innocents in Louisville, or it's Louisville, Lexington, or more often than not, if they have been in there for a few years, they have become pretty much institutionalized and have, I guess you would term social retardation. Sometimes those children at that time in the early days would end up going into the institution. For the only crime they had is that they were poor and they had no one to come get them and no one to raise them. And a lot of times these kids would grow up their whole lives like that and they're still thinking their mom or dads are coming to them. So you would have people have reports of having like their dress hems tugged on, you know, the little voices of children, mommy or something like that, you know, once mama coming, that kind of thing, I want to go home, that kind of stuff, which kills me. You know, being a father, there's the reality in it, you know, because don't get me wrong, I mean, once I first kind of started doing a little investigating, I really was ghost hunting at the time, you know, let's get an EVP, this is kind of fun, you're young, you don't think about the weight of what, you know, built to that, and that's one of those things that just breaks my heart. You know, these kids had a horrific life, grew up with some sort of comfort in there, but a lot of them would die from exposure or be mishandled by other stronger people that were in there and sometimes not make it. And now they're still stuck there, or at least some percentage of their spirit is stuck there. And like I said, for me, that's what made it writing, you know, the Hauntings of the Western Lunatic Asylum. It's kind of a bittersweet thing because, as you know, I have special needs children that me and my wife have adopted, and that's just heartbreaking to see that. Sure. You know, it brings a whole nother facet to that. It's not all, you know, Ghostbusters and, you know, the jackal running down the hallway with a cage on its head. You know, these were real people.
Mm-hmm. It's that human aspect to it that once you start putting those two together, and just even if some of these things happened, you know, so far back in history, these were people, these were lives, and this is someone's story. It's not just a story. It was lived and it was experienced by someone. Obviously, that sounds like a very, you know, right, very, very troubling, you know, thing to hear about and to learn about. I want to ask you, aside from that, and that would probably be up there because it involves kids, but aside from that specific story and that chapter in the life of this asylum, what would you say personally that we haven't talked about is one of the most disturbing or not even necessarily negatively disturbing, but just kind of shocking stories that accounts that you've heard come out of the asylum?
Well, this is actually one that did not make it into the book. I'm debating on, and this is what has happened. Just like with the first book, I would have people go, hey, these are really great, but you didn't mention maybe whatever happened in cell block C or something.
Sure.
And here, maybe there's like, well, why didn't you talk about the pretty girl or something like that? I said, well, I didn't have enough of the information about it. I heard a very light smattering, but I didn't get a story. I just heard, oh, there was an old legend, and there was nobody that had an experience. Supposedly, there was a little girl, and the I don't know if she was in some sort of little entertainer, like vaudevillian type of thing. Parents kind of traveled back and forth. I guess they were kind of like vaudevillian carny type people. Mm-hmm. And the mother, as I understand, was a singer and very beautiful and whatnot. Well, the dad was extremely heavy-handed and abusive and stuff, and ended up, I don't know if that's exactly if the story was that the mother died or if he inadvertently killed her in an argument. Well, the daughter, who was raised up around this, it damaged her. It damaged her emotionally, and even years later, the man died, and she was a young, very young woman, went to live with people, and she never felt pretty enough because all she ever heard was, you know, that, you know, you're ugly, you're useless, you're this and that. Well, you know, what's the term when you have like body dysphoria? You know, you mm-hmm. could be the perfect size, whatever, and you feel like you're horrific. And basically this young woman really began, it's kind of hard to talk about, began carving on herself and trying to make her features look like what she thought her features should look like. And you know, she didn't really have the money to go to plastic surgeons and stuff, so she did kind of what she could, and it about killed her. And but due to the fact that she had damaged her face and you know, her upper body and stuff so badly, she ended up being, you know, institutionalized. And you would still have some stories of like, in I think it was in the white section, the white female section in the bathroom, and you would hear sometimes a girl saying, am I pretty yet? Am I pretty yet? But it, the way it would talk, because the mouth was really disfigured, it would be kind of like, I'm not pretty yet, you know, in a weird kind of gurgle, just a horrific sound. And that, for some reason, that just really got me. You know, I have three daughters of my own, and you know, even now, obviously, you know, there's a lot of pressure put on young women, and a lot of things in society saying you have to be a size this and whatever. And it was so funny, like odd, that even though this happened in what, like vaudeville was like early 20s, maybe, like flapper ages, you know, early Catskills time, that is as relevant now as it was then. Yeah. And it seems like it, you know, would come to generally, you know, other pretty girls. I guess they were trying to get, the child was trying to get validation. And that's just crazy, because what's happening, they say what they would see sometimes, because sometimes they just get a voice, but sometimes they would see a form of somebody ripping at their face with almost like a, I don't know if you're familiar with like a corn knife or a tobacco knife that they would use in the field.
Sure.
It's kind of a curved thing, and she would be sitting there carving on herself, and it's just Jesus, you know. I mean, just thinking about it out, you know, talking about it out loud is just, you know, it's sobering. Yeah. That could have happened to begin with. I mean, you know, there was all kinds of horrific stories coming out through the Depression and times like that, but that this person is still living that over and over is just, it's hard for me.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing you can hope is looking at it from the perspective of, are they living it over and over, or is this just the energy replaying itself? That would be obviously best case scenario, that it's not a conscious thing. But you have to right. wonder in some of these cases, you know, that's what we hope for, but is that really what's going on?
True. You know, and then you also have to ask, because the reason I say this, when we would do investigations, we would go, me and my wife and some of the folks we'd have on the team, we would go to an area here in Western Kentucky, and there had been a horrifically bad, I think it was like a Spanish flu outbreak, and it come down the waterway people were traveling and whatever, and they just would come in and stop different little places. Well, what happened, it would decimate small communities. And I'm talking, you would have, I'm trying to remember, probably five infant graveyards. I mean, full of basically nothing but children. No, usually no more. I mean, anywhere from 4 or 5 months to maybe 3 or 4 years. Toddler, you know, toddler age.
Yeah.
And my wife, we would go through there, and it seemed like I would get EVPs, and sometimes, you know, might be a laugh or something, but she would actually get vocalizations, like trying to communicate with her, I guess because they realized she was a mom. So I have to wonder how much of what people experience they bring subconsciously to it. You know, what's the old thing? You know, if you put out positive, you'll get positive. If you put out negative, you'll get negative, that kind of thing. And maybe that's too simple a way to explain it. It's just something that I've noticed. And because for the longest time, you know, when I worked in the penitentiary, a lot of times I would get extremely, extremely violent, extremely vulgar type responses from entities, usually men. But for the most part, you know, my wife got female. I would occasionally get female. It's changed over time. And I think part of it was that I carried so much darkness from that institution unknowingly. Mm-hmm. And it was really strange because a lot of times she would get that same sort of thing. I actually had seen like where her clothing looked like it was being tugged. Mm-hmm. It was extremely strange and sad. So I wonder how much of that is true.
That wraps up our interview with Steve Asher about the Western State Lunatic Asylum. I hope you enjoyed today's program, and thank you for supporting The Grave Talks. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for The New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's The Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.